hello again there, folks. So I thought I would do one more video wrapping up the current theme of this year. For my, if I look back on the content that I've done this year, there's a theme of technology and a data-driven society, which, you know, relates to what's happening in the real world. That's absolutely dominated my content this year. And I thought that I would sort of get back to basics and wrap it all up, because there seems to be, some people think that I've become a conspiracy theorist or a libertarian or something like that, because it was as if I'd done like a shifted into something completely different in terms of what I talk about. In actual fact, long-time viewers will know that it's perfectly consistent with my general worldview, which is heavily influenced by Oswald Spengler. And so I thought a video was in order toward, you know, getting towards the end of the year, where I just kind of ask that question, like, so how is what we see in the world explained, or does it fit in with Oswald Spengler's cyclical view of history? Where would it map on that? Because obviously he's long dead, but does it fit into his model of the cycle of civilizations, which I've spoken about before? And I think we have to go back a little way to where we are now, and we have to go back to, because we are now in the winter of a civilization in his model. And I think we have to go back into the civilizational phase to see where this all started. And a good way of understanding this, if you're not very familiar with Spengler, like I've done other videos, but just to go over it briefly, you can think of it, the morphology, as if you think of a sapling, a seed which turns into a sapling, and then the sapling expresses itself fully as a fully grown tree, and it doesn't grow anymore, and then it can last for a long time, it's in full bloom, it's very large, and then it begins to decay and die off. And this is his rather bleak and pessimistic view of how civilizations have gone in this cycle over the time. And I think in our where we are now, we have to go back to the civilization phase a bit, which in for European, and we're going to specifically focus on the sort of Anglo-liberal world in this video. And if you go back to, say, the Victorian era, that was when that was Faustian man, this Western civilization at its fullest extent, at its peak, where it was most powerful relative to all other civilizations, where it had achieved its greatest achievements in philosophy and music and in science. It dominated the world entirely. And I think that when you go back there, can you see that there was some sort of cracks and some fault lines which were there, even though the civilization seemed completely dominant, as if it would be dominant forever? Can you like see if there was something not quite right that was going to come back and really cause us a headache? And there's quite a few things there. But what we can also see is, in terms of the Faustian spirit, like in full drive at that point, of with the usual motif, which I won't dwell on, of conquering space, of disappearing into infinite space all of the time, in all areas. So that goes for science, that goes for exploring the world, building aeroplanes a little bit later. Earlier on, you can see it in the Gothic cathedral. You can see it in the way that music, classic music, throughout is this kind of, it exists purely in phase space. And I think when we go back to the 19th century at that point, one interesting segue to sort of get us underway here is when we look at the media, what Spengler called the so-called free press, and the effect that the free press had on the civilization at that time. Because it's interesting to, like, you have to remember Spengler was writing this during and then just after World War I. And he, from his perspective, he was looking at the English speaking world, which was supposedly liberal, where the you know, you had a liberal democracy and the governments and parliaments, this was all an expression of the people's will. And in Germany, they didn't have that at all. But the question remains, like, were they then freer? Were people in England, say, freer? Did they have more liberty than the people in Germany? And it doesn't actually seem to be the case very much. But Germany is a bit of a special case. But from Spengler's point of view, the liberal democracy and the way it interacted with the press, the free press, was like a big con trick. And because what it did was give the people an impression that they had agency and that they had free will. But not really. They didn't really have it because the press was telling them what to think. And so I'll do a couple of quotes here. And Spengler says, "The dictator of party leader supports itself upon that of the press. The competitor strive by means of money to detach readers, nay, people en masse, from the hostile allegiance and to bring them under their own mind training. And all that they learn in this mind training is what is considered that they should know. A higher will puts together the picture of their world for them. There is no need now, as there was for Barak princes, to impose military service liability on the subject. One whips their souls with articles, telegrams and pictures until they clamour for weapons and force their leaders into a conflict to which they will be forced." And so you can see that in terms of World War One, which just happened there, the people go to war thinking they are fighting this great patriotic struggle. But from what Spengler is saying here is that they were just propagandized into that. But they think they are doing it. They've arrived there themselves when they haven't, of course. And then he moves on and he says, "What is truth? For the multitude, that which it continually reads and hears, a forlorn little drop may settle somewhere and collect grounds on which to determine the truth. But what it obtains is just its truth, the other, the public truth of the moment, which alone matters for effects and successes. In the fact world is today a product of the press. What the press wills is true. Its commanders evoke, transform, interchange truths. 3 weeks of press work and the truth is acknowledged by everybody." So, in other words, the press, from his perspective, looking at the Anglo-liberalism, the true classic liberalism, which prides itself on being, you know, everybody is an individual and they all arrive at their own truths, as he would say. They all arrive at their own opinions about the world through their own reason. And he's saying this is just complete nonsense. They will absorb and then repeat whatever the press wants them to the point where even if the masses, what he calls the reader mass, is what they've become, they will very quickly just regurgitate. Even if they oppose it at the start, it'll not take very long until almost the press can get almost everybody on board to have a certain opinion. And I think what's in his mind here is certainly the attitudes towards Germany at that period. And then another point that he brings in is that what the dynamism of our press wants is permanent effectiveness. It must keep men's minds continuously under its influence. Its arguments are overthrown as soon as the advantage of financial power passes over to the counter-arguments and brings these still oftener to men's eyes and ears. At that moment, the needle of public opinion swings round to the stronger pole. Everybody convinces himself at once of the new truth and regards himself awakened out of error. It's interesting because I'll come on to populism in a little bit, but you can see that what he's saying there is that the press absolutely has to have a monopoly on truth production for a society, even though it's kind of horrible to put it that way. But bear in mind, this is in looking at the Victorian era, looking at the early 20th century, when it was all about mass production. And if you're going to mass produce coal, and if you're going to mass produce ships, and you're going to have all of these factories, mass production of everything, which was really the rage then, also something typically Faustian, then it stands to reason that you can see that same mindset being applied to other forms. And in this case, it's the form of information which Spengler thinks is deadening to the human soul. So much so that he laments that the book was abolished by the reader mass of the printing press. The act of reading a book, for example, is a solitary endeavor, a solitary pastime, and then you will form your opinions and you'll have your own individual thoughts on that book. And he contrasts that to the press, which is by design for the masses to form mass opinion. And this is going to have, I mean, you know, just look at the world that we live in today. But what he's going to say here is that in the unsophisticated infancy of its power, the newspaper suffered from official censorship, which the champions of tradition wielded in self-defense. And the bourgeoisie cried out that the freedom of the spirit was in danger. Now the multitude placidly goes its way. It has definitively won for itself this freedom. But in the background, unseen, the new forces are fighting one another by buying the press. Without the readers observing it, the paper, and himself with it, changes masters. Here also money triumphs and forces the free spirits into its service. No tamer has his animals more under his power. Unleash the people as reader mass, and it will storm through the streets and hurl itself upon the target indicated, terrifying and breaking windows. A hint to the press staff, and it will become quiet and go home. The press today is an army with carefully organized arms and branches, with journalists as officers and readers as soldiers. But here, as in every army, the soldier obeys blindly, and war aims and operation plans change without his knowledge. And the changing of the hands takes us to the real critique, the real meat of this, is that when you think, well, okay, so the press can brainwash the masses and turn them into this sort of lump of reader mass, who then owns the press? And then you begin to see, okay, this is what Spengler would call the money power. So then we can go up to a higher level and we think, well, in this case, then the money power owns the press and they then form the opinion. So by extension, the opinions of the masses, even in this so-called liberal democracy where everybody's thinking for themselves and with a system of governance which is a result of the will of the people and, you know, voting and expressing their will on their own reason, all of this, in actual fact, all of it's manufactured by the press, and the press are owned by the money power, and the money power are going to dictate what's in the press. So therefore, the public opinion is just an expression of the will of the money power from Spengler's point of view. And if you then think of Germany back in that time that Spengler was writing, you can see how it must have seemed to them, this kind of classic Anglo-liberalism was just a big circus, and it was a big con trick being directed by the money power. And this, of course, was a real problem. This was going to lead to some hellish times later on a little bit, but, you know, that's for another time. And what I think's interesting is that you can see that in effect, the money power, this is why I dwelled on this for a bit, because the money power is here completely unbound. It's the world. It hasn't yet arrived, but you can see that when you have that kind of power where you just sway the opinions of the masses and it's the money power that's doing it for their own financial gain, once again, you can see that the money power completely unbound from any kind of ethic or any knowing any when it can stop, when it's enough. That is that's a Faustian trait too. If you think about the amount of sums, you know, if you think about something where America is $27 trillion in debt and all of this ridiculousness, this would have been incomprehensible to other civilizations. But when things get kicked into this phase space, into this complete abstraction, that's a typically Faustian thing. It's always in the infinite. It's always in space. It doesn't. The Western civilization enjoys that and feels at home in all of this, whereas other civilizations would have just felt completely baffled by it. And so you can see that this sort of waking consciousness, as Spengler would have called it, it infests absolutely everything about the civilization. But I do think that back then, back in, let's say, the Victorian era, the manner in which the money power was manipulating the masses through the media and then onwards, it would have been better hidden, because there were still other forms. There was still some more of an intellectual life. There was still a religious life, an artistic life, and just a general sense of community and being in the world. And what's happened over time is that the money, the capital, has supplanted, or those other forms have all kind of died on the vine, because of the reader mass, because of just people being fed their opinions through, and that by the money power, which would always be towards the drive of profit and not spiritualism or artistic creativity. And so the capital, the money power, becomes the absolute dominant form. The rest begin to die away. But what you're still left with is science and technology, science and technological innovation, because that actually helps the money power in its quest to just buy up everything. And so the more traditional forms die off, and, you know, like what I said about the tree, where these are like branches which have now fallen off the tree of Western civilization, and you still have these big ones left over, dominating everything. People will probably be quite surprised at, because this almost seems like a sort of left-wing or Marxist criticism of capital. But it's coming from a position which is more like a third positionist, the Prussian socialist model of Spengler, and of the Germans of that time, who were very critical of what they saw, very critical of this worldview of the liberal Western liberalism, specifically Atlantic, American, and Anglo. John David Ebert, who's really great on this. All of this is, he has this idea that you can trace this strange place of Germany in Western civilization, and you can compare it to Carthage, ancient Carthage, because in the classic civilization of Greece and Rome, who had their own symbol of the physical form in the here and now, you can see that with the statues and so on, but you get something similar where Carthage liked the old ways. Carthage was a sort of relatively reactionary, and they liked mysticism. It was a very old civilization. And then you've also got Rome rising, and you get this tension between the two. And if you're going to head fully into the civilizational phase, which will be more materialistic, then the older sort of outlier has to be shed. It has to be put down. And Ebert's sort of thesis was that this is the relationship between the mainly at that time what would eventually be America, and you can see the similarities between America and Rome, even just in the architecture. But Germany represented the older form, which had to be done away with, otherwise the civilization couldn't progress, because Germany had a very deeply reactionary sort of metaphysic to it. And so this is obviously what gave rise to all kinds of conflicts, but as a sort of subterranean view on it, rather than looking at the politics and the players in the money power. But it was, in the end, that's what it comes down to, this push towards a more money-driven, materialistic civilization needs to shed the skin of all of the older elements, all these older forms which are holding it back. And that's exactly what's happened. So when this is why I think it was a good place to start, by looking at the relationship with the press. Because what it does is frame quite nicely the idea that the dominant power in the West is absolutely the money power, and they're not. The money power is now unbound by anything, by the morality. It dictates the morality, and so this is where we find ourselves at the moment. And I'm sure the comments on the press, everybody, you know, the media, being the mass media, telling the people what to think, it resonates more than ever. It's quite astonishing to see it like that. But something else is happening as well. And it's that there's a hollowing out of the democratic process. It's no surprise that populist rebellions happened across the West as social media was coming of age. The populist age lasted from 2010, more or less, in the West. There were some other ones in other places in the world, which the system was fine with for strange reasons. But in the West, it lasted from about 2010 to about 2018, encompassing Donald Trump, and you saw various populist nationalist-style parties pop up across Europe. And the reason for that is because the age of the social media, it meant that people had their voice. And as Spengler said just earlier then, I quote, whenever there's a gap, whenever the sort of the grip of the press is there's an outlet which isn't in the grip of the money power, then you'll quickly see that people will begin formulating different truths that the system doesn't like, because at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about here. It's a system which controls absolutely everything about the West. The so-called liberal free West is actually just manufactured from the money power. And so as soon as they saw what was happening with the internet and the social media age, what did we see? We saw giant corporations come in, buy it all up, and then begin mass campaigns to censor everybody. All of these institutions, all of these NGOs got on board. We've got to shut it down. We've got to control these platforms and moderate them ourselves, because we can't allow for a dissident opinion to form. And so social media became just another organ of the system, in the same way that the press did, to manufacture consent all the way back in Wardian England or whenever. And the problem, what we see, is that there is the centre, if you want to call it that. It controls absolutely everything, and it even controls its own opposition. If you think of something like Extinction Rebellion or BLM, in theory they are speaking truth to power. In practice, all they do is further the aims, and especially the social policy, of what the money power wants. And so this is why democracy begins to get hollowed out, because with this level of dominance, where you simply don't have any institutions left, not even the Catholic Church, nothing. There's no institution left which is not doing the bidding of this power. Then people become completely disillusioned by it, and they know that however they cast their vote, it's not going to matter a damn. Whoever gets in, it doesn't matter, because it all leads back. It all goes back to the same place. Nothing really changes. And even when the sort of the press can't quite manage to, in the age of the internet, it can't quite manage to keep a grasp on the masses the way it used to, what it produces is a disaffected mass within the population, and that's what's going to lead to populism. But it's even when they shut it all down, it still means that you've got masses of people who are now just simply don't believe it, not only in the democratic process, but in the system as a whole, where everything seems to be corrupted and nothing seems to be authentic. And so the question then becomes, well, what do you do about it? But there's another aspect to this, and it's that there's the technology side of it, which is where we're beginning to see some very ominous and terrifying things coming in, because the technology side of it imposes itself on us directly in a way that didn't happen so much in the past. And so what we see is the money merging itself with other forms, with the science, which is a big thing at the moment, which we have to obey, and then also with especially technology, and this is pretty much exactly what a digital currency is. But the problem with it is that it's so boring and it's so materialistic that they're going to have to find a way to pacify the masses. And so now we see this big push where everybody's going to be permanently hooked up to the internet and living in the metaverse, in Zuckerberg's metaverse. And here again, you see that the once again, we're off into infinite space. We are now going into infinite cyberspace in a similar way that in the past, it would be like pioneers breaking through the Northwest Passage. And this is why I think this is all extremely dangerous and manipulative, for especially for Western people, because it's kind of a thing that attracts us to disappear into all this stuff. But it's also a way to say that, well, the life which the money and the technology is lining up for you is so banal and so materialistic and so devoid of any kind of meaning that we have to like substitute it with this other reality. And so what we have now is a situation where this sort of horrible technocratic world is forcing us all to take part. It won't leave you alone, or will it? Is there a way to escape it? This, in Spengler's view, there's a couple of things with this. So the first thing is that because you've got all of these problems and all of these rifts and a false understanding of people, a disaffected mass, you're also sort of paving the way to a possible Caesar figure, which I've discussed in another video. And actually, a lot of people kind of get into that with Spengler. But these kinds of fault lines that are beginning to emerge now, and in my opinion, the sort of technocratic mindset is off. I don't think it's a very good sort of description of what people, how people should live or how people think. But even then, it's like purely data and number driven, and just like the money power previously, there's no brakes on it. It just goes on. It just goes on. We go on into infinite data sets, which will map out every living being on the planet. And if you find all of this, the digital currencies in face space, in digital space, which doesn't actually exist anywhere in a physical sense. And then if you're not happy with all of that life, then you can disappear off. You can upload your mind into the metaverse and you can create whatever reality you want. And so it just goes on and on and on. So that's one side of it. And there's going to be a secondary elite, which is sort of dislocated by this, which could possibly form some kind of... It isn't just Caesar. It isn't just one figure. It's Caesarism. And it's not a happy time either. But another aspect of this, which I find fascinating, is when you, at these late stage civilization, you do get the fellaheen, and it's this drive of people who are just absolutely worn out and exhausted with the current materialistic state of things and how fake everything is. And they long and yearn for this more rooted life back in the land, which has been taken away from them because everything has been territorialized by capital. By and technology, and by the metropolis, by the thinking of the city, and now technology directly just imposing itself on everybody. And so you see more and more in this happens always in civilizations where there's a splinter of people go back, look to go back to the land. It may also form a sort of political backlash as well that goes in tandem with the Caesarism. But it's interesting that we can actually see this in Western civilization. You talk about more and more people talking about going off grid, people saying they're just tired of it all and they don't want to know. And it's because, as Spengler says, people become just sick to the back teeth of the fake life offered by all of this, the being on that treadmill all of the time. One possible way out of this, one political insurgency, if it could even happen in the current situation, is what I call on another video, grimdark nationalism or grimdark traditionalism. And when we look, in my opinion, at one of the reasons why all of the populist movements failed to sort of have to amount to a huge kind of insurgency throughout the population, is that most of the population are very comfortable and they've been duped into taking this soma, which the system provides them with, And so they don't really feel the need to become politically radical in any way. Well, the thing is, that's probably going to... The materialism is probably going to wear thin when they are literal slaves in a smart grid, being monitored night and day, and having their digital currencies being taken away if they say the wrong thing on the internet, or if their carbon reduction quotas aren't in order, and all of this kind of thing. And so, but if you wanted to have a genuine kind of radical politics, they're going to have to accept that all of those goodies would disappear. You would have a kind of sense of authenticity. You would have a life with some modicum of meaning again, but you're going to pay the price with goods because it just wouldn't happen. And it would be like your country would be like a rogue state. So there's this kind of choice coming down the road quite quickly, where it's like, do you basically do the masses go into the cyber pod and eat the bugs and stay on the hamster wheel and try and keep the digital, try and keep the algorithm happy, or do they reject all of that paradigm entirely, but then concede that things will probably be materially better off because you just won't have access to what the system will give you. The grid is not going to help you in that regard. And it could be a politics which is based on seizing the assets of the oligarchs and just telling them to get lost. But it would be a very materially impoverished, for a time being, life. But it would at least have some kind of meaning to it. It would at least have some kind of authenticity. And so that's the gist of what I would call one possible future, which may also go along with the sort of the Fellaheen thing. The big horror is this idea that you also get the second religiousness. And the second religiousness may well turn out to be transhumanism. So it's this, again, it's this kind of Faustian thing which has always been with us, where you do want to sort of disappear into infinite space. But instead of being traveling in the stars, it's going to be in cyberspace. And, not to get too grim, but is it possible that one day there'll just be sort of vast warehouses with people in boxes with their conscious hooked up to the internet and virtual realities, while all of Western civilization is just being invaded and ravaged, and all the buildings are collapsing into ruins, and the people, the sort of Fellaheen, or the people who went back to the land are feeding their goats in Wembley Stadium, and all of this kind of thing, because these are late civilizational things, and they've happened again and again and again. And so this is, in my view, this is kind of where we're at. This is where things seem to be going. And or is it not? Because it seems to me that it's very, very difficult to argue against what Spengler is saying here. Because when it comes to the cultural phase, and he talks about the dominance of money, he talks about the sort of the drive of civilizations, it's all correct. And when I began to realise what's been happening in the West, when I began to realise the extent of the sort of the technocratic side of it, the imposition of technology, I realised then that I kind of got it, what the technology was doing and how intrusive it was becoming, because once again, just like all of these other forms, there was no longer any brakes on it. And so the big brains behind all of this are the technocrats, which is this phrase that we hear more and more these days. But when we ask ourselves, what is a technocracy? What is a technocrat? And it's the official definition is the government or control of society or industry by an elite of technical experts. And so it's ruled by expert. And it's purely immoral and utilitarian, because they'll just run the numbers and crunch the data. And then informs what right and wrong will be for the greater good, all of this kind of language that we hear now. And so they exist like priests in the Middle Ages, because the technocrats have access to knowledge that the rest of us don't. And then it's demanded of us that we trust the scientists. But, why would you trust a scientist and not a journalist when they've all been bought up, when the money power has corrupted absolutely everything? So in the end, they can do whatever they like. And you'll also notice when the scale of the ambition here to merge the world with the machine, once again, it's unbound. It's unbounded by anything higher than itself. There's no other institutions to stand in its way or counter-signal it, because they too have all fallen by the wayside. And all we have is these two or three forms left which are merging into one: the money, the technology, and the science. Although I think the science has just completely gone. So it's money and technology buying up the world and creating this perfect grid for everybody to live in. And they think, when they say you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, then, well, that you'll be happy because they are going to supply you with your basic needs in the same way that in a giant battery full of chickens, they will have enough grain to eat. And so we've run the numbers, and that means that you should be happy. And if you're not, then you can always go in the metaverse. And so we're coming sort of face to face with a sort of the final battle of the Western man, which is in effect the battle against his own machine. I was watching Terminator, the original movie, not the rubbishy remakes and reboots. But I was astonished when I watched the first Terminator movie, just how representative of death the actual robot is. Like, he is literally a walking skeleton, and what he's doing is going around killing everybody. And so you've got this perfect convergence of technology as death. And another example would be there's many Faustian themes in 2001 Space Odyssey by Stanley Kubrick. And you see, again, this theme of HAL 2000, where the artificial intelligence has become active and is now dictating to the man, the Western man, how he will live and what he will do. And this is now what's facing us. And I think this is kind of like what got me so fascinated in this subject. And it seems that there's many Spenglerian themes in there. It's worth bearing in mind the fate of the original Faust, Goethe's Faust, and Marlowe's Faust, who was, depending on which version you read, dragged to hell. He learned all of the wonders of the world. All knowledge was his. He knew it all. There was no limits on what he could do and what he could learn and where he could go. It was all there. The world was his. But in the end, he did get dragged off to hell, again, depending on which version that you read. And this seems to me the sort of the path that we're on, that we've learned how to make the most astonishing digital technological wonders, but it could very well become our hell, a digital hell that we created for ourselves. And I'm determined to resist that, and to make the case that this is not how we should be living, and it's not how we want to live, and it's hellish. And I sometimes look at pictures of like a farmer in Siberia sitting on his like 1960s Soviet tractor, and there's a sort of contentment in that simple life, and that's what's being denied to us through this, through where we don't have access to an authentic organic life anymore, and it seems to be slipping further and further away. So thanks for listening, folks, and I'll catch you later.